I want to invite you to open your Bibles to Luke chapter 8, verse 40. If you are a guest with us this morning, if you don't have a Bible and would like to follow along, there's some Bibles at the table in the back. If you don't own a Bible, we'd love for you to take one of those as our gift to you this morning. We've been walking through Luke's gospel, and today we come to the last part of Luke chapter 8, verses 40 to 56. I grew up in Southern Ontario. I grew up a sports fan, and among the various sports that I enjoyed following and playing, one was basketball. And this was a long time ago before Canada had an NBA team, and so I was a Detroit Pistons fan. Back in the days when their main rivals were the Boston Celtics with Larry Bird and the Los Angeles Lakers with Magic Johnson. Well, just this past week, November 7th, marked 26 years since that day that maybe some of you remember. It was the day that Magic Johnson announced that he was HIV positive and also announced that he would be retiring immediately from the NBA. Initially, he said he didn't know how he had contracted the disease, but later he acknowledged that it was through having multiple sexual partners over the course of his playing career. Despite his retirement, NBA fans voted for him to play in the All-Star game that was held in Orlando, Florida in spring of 92. Some other NBA players, including a number who were on his own team, challenged that. They resisted that. They argued that he shouldn't be allowed to play, that there was a risk of contamination. Basketball, for a non-contact sport, there's a remarkably high amount of contact. And sweaty bodies against sweaty bodies, the risk of an open wound on the court. There was this fear among other NBA players that they could become contaminated by having contact with him. They didn't want to risk disease. They didn't want to risk contamination. They wanted to be safe, to be healthy, uncontaminated. And so they argued that he shouldn't be allowed to play, that they didn't want him on the court. As it turned out, he did end up playing in the 92 All-Star game. He also played in 92 in the Olympics for the U.S. Dream Team. This morning, we come to a text in Luke's gospel that recounts for us two more miracle stories, two more stories of Jesus performing mighty deeds, one sandwiched right in the middle of the other. And both of them, in both stories, touch plays a prominent role. Jesus comes in contact with two different people. In one story, someone reaches out and touches him. And in the other, Jesus reaches out and touches the other person. And what we will recognize, what we will realize, what we will see as we dive into these stories, though not explicitly expressed, the matter of touch and the issue of contamination actually play a very central role to the stories. And as we unpack them, we will discover God's promise, the promise that through faith in Jesus, through His touch, Jesus' touch brings healing and brings life to all who receive His touch, to all who reach out to Jesus and touch Him. If you have your Bible, I invite you to follow along as I read Luke 8, verses 40 to the end of the chapter. Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed Him, for they were all expecting Him. Then a man named Jairus, a synagogue leader, came and fell at Jesus' feet, pleading with Him to come to his house, because his only daughter, a girl of about 12, was dying. As Jesus was on His way, the crowds almost crushed Him. And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind Him and touched the edge of His cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." But Jesus said, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at His feet. In the presence of all the people, she told why she had touched Him and how she had been instantly healed. Then He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace." While Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," he said. "Don't bother the teacher anymore." Hearing this, Jesus said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed." When he arrived at the house of Jairus, he did not let anyone go in with him except Peter, John, and James, and the child's father and mother. Meanwhile, all the people were wailing and mourning for her. "Stop wailing," Jesus said. "She is not dead, but asleep." They laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But he took her by the hand and said, "My child, get up." Her spirit returned, and at once she stood up. And then Jesus told them to give her something to eat. Her parents were astonished, but he ordered them not to tell anyone what had happened. During the rest of the time that we have together this morning, I want to walk through this story and explore these two stories by asking three questions. First, what do we hope for? Secondly, what do we fear? Third, what are we invited to believe? What do we hope for? What do we fear? What are we invited to believe? Luke begins the passage, these stories, by telling us, "Now when Jesus returned, a crowd welcomed him, for they were all expecting him." That's interesting, isn't it? We know, if you've been with us the last number of weeks, Jesus, this story follows immediately on the heels of the two previous stories. Jesus and his disciples had been somewhere in Galilee, probably close to Capernaum. He'd been teaching there. The end of the day, probably weary after a day full of ministry, they got into a boat to get away, to go rest. They got in a boat, they sailed off into the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus found a spot on the boat and he went to sleep. And that's when his disciples experienced this massive storm. Experienced fishermen, some of them. They were freaked out. And they wake Jesus. Remember, if you were here, not to say, "Jesus, can you still the storm?" But, "Jesus, grab a bucket and bail. We're about to drown." And Jesus stands up and he rebukes the wind. He rebukes the waves. The storm stops. And the disciples say, "Who is this?" And they sail on and they arrive on the eastern side of the sea. And there they meet a man who is possessed by a legion of demons. He is naked, living with the dead in the tombs. And Jesus delivers him of these demons. And he is set right in his right mind. And he is dressed. And it freaks out the people of the town. And they say, "Please go away." And so Jesus and his disciples get in the boat and they sail across. And here they arrive back in Galilee, and there's a crowd expecting him. It's odd, really. How did they know that? Did Jesus say he'd be back then? Perhaps they just got used to his rhythm of leaving and coming back after a short period of rest. We don't know, but there's a crowd there to welcome him. And what's interesting is that they're there ready to welcome him, in sharp contrast to those on the other side of the sea who just said, "Please go away." So the text opens. Jesus arrives back in Galilee to a crowd welcoming him. Let's turn our attention now to the first character other than Jesus, to whom Luke introduces us, a man by the name of Jairus. Jairus is a synagogue ruler, a synagogue leader. Synagogue was simply a meeting place. Synagogue, the word literally means assembly. This is the place of worship. This is the place where God's people, the Jewish people, would gather. When they weren't in the temple in Jerusalem, they would gather in synagogues. Anywhere where there were at least 10 Jewish men, a synagogue could be established. This was a place for worship, for prayer. And Jairus is a leader of the synagogue, a ruler. That is, here in this local place, he was a man of some prominence. He would plan and be responsible for arranging their times of worship, selecting those who would lead in prayer, selecting those who would read Scripture, those who would preach and teach. So though many Jewish religious leaders to this point in the story have responded by rejecting Jesus, clearly that's not a uniform response straight across the board. Now, Jairus is not one of the teachers of the law. He's not a Pharisee. He's not a priest. But he is a religious leader in this local area. And he comes to Jesus. He comes to Jesus and he falls at Jesus' feet. He humbles himself. This was something that you did. It was a way of acknowledging the authority of the other person. So Jairus, this leading authority in the religious world of his community, comes to Jesus and he falls at his feet, acknowledging the authority of Jesus, which is something we've been encountering. Jesus has already demonstrated his authority over the forces of nature. He has demonstrated his authority over the powers of darkness. And now this religious leader, Jairus, comes to Jesus and acknowledges Jesus' authority and falls at his feet before him. Now, Luke doesn't tell us, but we know that Jairus is pleading with Jesus to come and heal his daughter. His daughter, 12 years old, is at home and she's dying. She's close to death. everyone who is a parent. I want you to imagine for a moment what that moment would have been like. In fact, there may be some here who have experienced that. One of your children, gravely ill. What is it Jairus hopes for? He hopes that Jesus, this teacher, will come. He hopes that Jesus will be able to heal his little girl. He hopes that Jesus will be able to avert her death. She's dying. He hopes that Jesus can stop that from happening. He hopes that Jesus can set things right. It's not right for his little girl to die. So Jairus comes and he falls down at Jesus' feet in humility and in desperation, hoping, desperately hoping, pleading with Jesus to come. There is another character that we meet in these verses, a woman. We're not told her name, just really a couple things about her. She was in the crowd that day that she had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her, is what Luke says. Now, really important for us, and we could miss this if we don't understand the cultural implications, this is a Jewish area. This is a Jewish woman living in a Jewish community. And so the fact that she's bleeding and has been bleeding for 12 years has massive implications for this story. Listen to these words from Leviticus 15 that share with us some of the ritual law that the Jews lived according to. Leviticus 15, verse 25, when a woman has a discharge of blood for many days at a time, other than her monthly period, or has a discharge that continues beyond her period, she will be unclean as long as she has the discharge, just as in the days of her period. Any bed she lies on while her discharge continues will be unclean, as is her bed during her monthly period. And anything she sits on will be unclean, as during her period. Anyone who touches them will be unclean. They must wash their clothes and bathe with water, and they will be unclean till evening. So we need to understand this as we read this story, as we meet this woman. For 12 years, she has been in a perpetual state of uncleanness. A state that would have prevented her from ever gathering with God's people for worship. A condition that would have meant for her 12 years of exclusion from community. She was a social outcast, avoided by others who didn't want to come in contact with her. Because it would make them unclean. And though their uncleanness was temporary, it was bothersome because you had to go home and wash all your clothes and take a bath, and you were unclean for the rest of the day. She was an outcast. She was excluded from the community. For 12 years, she's been in a perpetual state of ritual uncleanness. Not only that, but she's destitute. She's destitute. She's poor. She's got nothing. Luke doesn't include these details, but Mark does in his account. He says this: she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. She has spent all that she had. She has tried desperately to find help. She has wanted desperately to be made well, so that she could be welcomed back into community, welcomed back in a relationship. She has felt the pain of exclusion for so long, 12 years without human touch. What does this woman hope for? She hopes that Jesus can heal her. She hopes that Jesus can make her clean again. She hopes that Jesus can bring to an end her exclusion. She hopes that Jesus can set things right. What is it you and I hope for? We all hope. We all hope. We hope for something. Tim Keller writes, "You and I are unavoidably and irreducibly hope-based creatures." We all hope. What is it you hope for? We all hope. And though the particulars might differ, our hope is not all that dissimilar to the hope of Jairus and the hope of this woman. He hoped for life for his daughter in the face of death. She hoped for healing both physically and socially, relationally, after years of exclusion and isolation. They both lived with, were experiencing the pain and the brokenness that each of us shares too as we live our lives in a fallen and broken world, as we live our broken lives. And they longed for things to be different. They longed for things to not be broken. And we too so often long for things to be different, for things to be the way they are supposed to be. Now, though they may not have recognized it, and though we may not often recognize it or express it this way, what they really hope for, what we really hope for, is what the Bible describes with the word shalom. Shalom is a word often translated in English to the with the word peace, but peace is included in it, but shalom is deeper and richer than just peace. It includes peace, but it's not simply peace as in the absence of conflict or the absence of noise. It's the right relatedness of all things. It's all things being the way they're supposed to be. It communicates well-being and completeness and fullness. It gets at the reality of us as creatures being rightly related with our Creator, that the relationship that's severed between us and God would be established, that we would have intimacy with our Creator, that our relationships with one another would be those of harmony, that we would be rightly related to this creation, that all things would be as they were meant to be. Conflict is an enemy of shalom. Exclusion is an enemy of shalom. Sickness is an enemy of shalom. Death is an enemy of shalom. But God's desire for us, God's desire is that His whole creation would experience shalom, the right relatedness of all things. But because of our sin, His good creation has been plunged into darkness. Because of our sin, the creation has been broken. We are broken. We have rebelled against God, our Maker. Because of sin, there is disease. Because of sin, there is conflict. Because of sin, there is exclusion. Because of sin, there is death. Because of sin, our relationship with God has been severed. Because of sin, our relationships with one another have been wrecked. Because of sin, things in this world are not the way they're supposed to be. And we are all left hoping. Hoping for what is not. Hoping for things to be set right. And I believe that we all, regardless of who you are or what you articulate as your beliefs, that deep inside us, we know, we recognize when we read the paper, when we experience the own brokenness of our own lives, we recognize that things shouldn't be this way. And we hope for things to be set right. We hope for the same things as Jairus and this woman. We hope for things to be set right. Now, often the truth is our hopes get hijacked, get misdirected. In the midst of a broken world, in the midst of our own brokenness, we often direct our hopes to lesser things, thinking that those lesser things will satisfy us, that those lesser things is what we really long for, but they won't. We can read countless stories about people who have reached the pinnacle of whatever they pursue. Star athletes, musicians, people in the business world, incredibly wealthy people, they get to the pinnacle and they go, it's empty. It's empty. It doesn't fill that need. And so they discover even then that what they hoped for, what they thought would satisfy, didn't. And it's because what they truly long for, even if they can't articulate it, even if they don't recognize it, what they long for is shalom, the right relatedness of all things, beginning with a right relatedness with their Creator. C.S. Lewis writes, if we find ourselves with a desire that nothing in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that we were made for another world. We were created to know and love and live in relationship with God, our Maker. We were created to live in a world of shalom where all things are as they were intended to be. And so we are creatures of hope. We all hope. We all hope for something. Let's turn now to our second question. What do we fear? Jesus begins to make his way to Jairus' home, presumably to heal his daughter. That's what we would assume. But this journey, this traveling from wherever Jairus met him to Jairus' home proves to be difficult. Far more difficult than Jairus would have hoped for. Look at what Luke tells us. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him. I want you to imagine for a moment the intense frustration that Jairus must have felt. He is desperate. His daughter is at death's door. He has managed to find Jesus. He has pleaded with Jesus to come because he believes that Jesus can stop his daughter from dying. And Jesus begins to come, and this crowd of people is in the way. And he's desperate, and he must have been incredibly frustrated as that procession ground to a halt, as Jesus just is enveloped with people who are crushing him. The narrow streets of an ancient city, there wasn't a lot of room, and so a lot of people would have meant traffic jam. This crush of people Luke tells us about. Imagine his frustration, his desperation. His daughter's dying, and Jesus' progress is so slow. And then to make things infinitely worse, Jesus stops. He stops. Look at verse 42, about halfway through. As Jesus was on his way, the crowds almost crushed him, and a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, but no one could heal her. She came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak, and immediately her bleeding stopped. "Who touched me?" Jesus asked. When they all denied it, Peter said, "Master, the people are crowding and pressing against you." Jairus desperately wants Jesus to get to his home. Jairus desperately wants Jesus to get to his daughter before it's too late. And now Jesus stops. And he asks this ridiculous question. As people are pressing in, crowded upon in upon him, he says, "Who touched me?" Now, Jairus, probably losing his mind, so frustrated, so desperate, he doesn't say anything, but Peter says it. Peter goes, "Jesus, look around. Silly question. Everybody's touching you, Jesus. Forget about it, let's move on." But Jesus stops. His journey to Jairus' home is delayed. Now, I want us to pause with Jesus. Let's stop with him and explore this interruption. The person who touched Jesus, of course, is none other than the woman that we've met already, the woman who is unclean, who has been in a perpetual state of uncleanness for 12 years. Here's the remarkable thing. She came up behind Jesus. Somehow, in the midst of the crowd, she managed to press through to Jesus. She reached out and touched his cloak, the edge of his cloak. And in that moment, her bleeding stopped immediately. She felt it. Something happened to her body. She touched him, and in that moment, her bleeding stopped. She was well. It worked. It worked. And she turns and she begins to sneak away just like she had snuck up to him. And she did sneak up to him. After all, she's unclean. She's been a social outcast for 12 years. She didn't just approach Jesus openly. She snuck up behind him. The crowds would have freaked out. "Whoa, unclean, get away." She sneaks up behind Jesus and now she's sneaking away. But Jesus will not let her go away quietly. "Who touched me? Who touched me?" And Peter speaks for many and says, "Jesus, that's a crazy question. What do you mean? There's a gazillion people here pressing in on you." But Jesus persists. He says, "Someone touched me. I know that power has gone out from me." Almost sounds magical, doesn't it? I mean, superstitious, almost like this healing was unintentional. It was accidental. Whoop, someone just, "Hey, who took my power?" Right? It almost seems accidental. This woman treats Jesus like a magic talisman. Just, "If I touch him, his power will flow into me. If I don't make a scene and I just touch him, maybe it will make me well." And so she sneaks up and reaches out and touches him, and And then she wants to sneak away. But Jesus will not have it that way. Her condition has meant exclusion and loneliness for her for 12 years. And Jesus is determined that everyone will know that she has been made clean. That everyone will know that she has been healed. That everyone will know that she has been restored to relationships, to community. Who touched me? Luke writes these words next. Then the woman, seeing that she could not go unnoticed, came trembling and fell at his feet. She is afraid. Trembling. Had she been wrong to do what she had done? Would this cure be undone? What would the crowd's reaction to her be? She's unclean, and she came and pressed through them. And so she comes to Jesus, trembling, afraid, and she falls at his feet. And she tells him what happened. She tells him why she came. And Jesus speaks words of incredible tenderness. You know, this is the only time in the entire New Testament that Jesus addresses a woman with the word daughter. He says, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Go in peace. This is a great moment for this woman. A moment she would never, ever forget. It was a moment when her life was changed radically. After 12 years of being excluded and not being touched, not being welcomed as being an outcast, after 12 years of that, her life is restored. She's restored to community. She's clean again. She can worship her God with her people again. But let's remember Jairus. Desperate. Desperate and frustrated. And afraid that Jesus will arrive too late. And sure enough, Luke tells us, while Jesus was still speaking, someone came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. Your daughter is dead, he said. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Imagine that moment for Jairus. He had tried so hard. He'd been so close. But now all hope was gone. His daughter was dead. His greatest fear that he wouldn't get to Jesus in time, that Jesus wouldn't make it to his daughter in time. His greatest fear has materialized before him. His hopes have been shattered. If I were to ask you, what is it you fear? How would you respond? Perhaps initially we would just share some amusing things, amusing to some of us, scared of spiders, scared of snakes, scared of dentists, public speaking. But if we went a little deeper, if we got a little bit more vulnerable and we shared the things that sometimes keep us up at night, what is it you are afraid of? You're afraid of illness. Afraid of growing old, afraid of broken relationships, afraid of losing someone you love, afraid ultimately of death. Death is described in the pages of Scripture as an enemy. Death entered the world because of sin. When we think about the way things should be, death is excluded. Yet it is an inevitable part of life for all of us. The day will come for every one of us, unless Jesus returns first, where we will be laid to rest in the earth. The fact that we live in one of the most death-denying cultures in history doesn't change the fact that time marches on, that the grave approaches. Death often lies at the heart of many of our fears, can certainly. I want us to turn now to the third question I wanted to ask this morning. And that is, what are we invited to believe? Look with me at what Jesus says to Jairus in verse 50. Don't be afraid, just believe, and she will be healed. Don't be afraid. Really, Jesus? Don't be afraid. My daughter just died, Jesus. Don't be afraid. What do you mean she'll be healed? What do you mean just believe? Believe what, Jesus? I believed that you could heal her. I believed that you could have stopped this. Don't be afraid, just believe. Let's watch what happened next. They finally arrive at Jairus' house too late. The mourners have already gathered. The wailing has begun. The funeral will happen soon, one would presume. Jesus takes three of his disciples, Peter, John, and James, along with Jairus and his wife, the parents of this girl, into the home. And on their way in, there's this exchange between Jesus and the mourners that moves them from tears to laughter. She's not dead, just sleeping. What? She's dead. We've seen death before, Jesus. You're deluded. But Jesus, undeterred, goes to where the lifeless body of this young girl lays, followed by Jairus and his wife, Peter, John, and James. And then the most incredible moment. Imagine what this would have been like if you were one of those parents. Tears blurring your vision, running down your face. Your little girl is dead. And they see Jesus reach out and touch her dead corpse. Again, something one didn't do. It meant contamination and uncleanness. You were not to touch a dead body. And then they hear his voice speak these words, "My child, get up." And she jumps up. She jumps up. I mean, she was dead. She jumps up. They scarcely can believe it. She's alive again. And then an interesting note Luke shares with us. Jesus tells her parents to give her something to eat. 12-year-olds that I have known eat all the time. This girl has been sick, perhaps has not eaten for a while, and so Jesus, in this really tender human moment, says, give her something to eat. Oh, and by the way, don't tell anyone. Now, I don't know about you, but that's just hard to grasp, hard to understand, and quite frankly, I don't think I have a great explanation for you. Maybe it's simply, you know, focus on caring for her, don't worry about telling people. It sounds stronger than that. He commands them not to tell anyone, but the reality is there's a funeral procession gathering outside, and they're going to have to be informed that the plans have changed. And it's going to be written all over the faces of this mom and this dad. I mean, they were weeping over their dead daughter, and now their faces will be beaming with joy. Not to mention the fact that they're gonna hear this 12-year-old girl ripping around town again. So it's not like this is going to be a secret. But for some reason, Jesus says, give her something to eat, and he orders them not to tell anyone what happened. Both of these stories call us to faith in Jesus. Explicitly in the story of Jairus, Jesus says, don't be afraid, just believe. Jairus had believed. He had believed that Jesus could heal his dying daughter. He had believed that Jesus could stop her from dying. But even now, in the face of death, Jairus is called to believe. Just believe. Don't be afraid. Just believe. And in the story of the woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, her faith is celebrated. Her faith is affirmed by Jesus. Jesus says, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace. Her faith, her imperfect faith, her superstitious faith, if I just touch him, maybe the power will flow. Jesus affirms her faith. It's not perfect faith. It's not a faith that understands everything well. It's kind of magical. It's kind of superstitious. But Jesus affirms her faith. He says, daughter, your faith has healed you. She believed. She believed that Jesus had the power to make her well. We are called to believe. We are called to put our faith in Jesus. But to what end? In these stories, some pretty remarkable things happen. So, does this mean that if we believe in Jesus, we will experience physical healing from all disease and illness? Does this mean that if we believe our loved ones, even if they pass away, that they'll be made alive again by Jesus? What is it that I have been saying, if you've been around here for the last few weeks, what is it I've been saying about Jesus' miracles and his mighty deeds? They're not party tricks. They're not simply about gathering a crowd. They are revelatory. That is, they reveal something about who Jesus is and what Jesus is doing. That Jesus came to establish shalom. He came to set all things right, to overcome sickness, to overcome pain, to overcome suffering, to overcome death, to restore creation to its intended state. There's a detail I have not drawn your attention to yet in these stories, and it's not insignificant. How long had this woman been subject to bleeding? 12 years. How old was this little girl that Jesus brought back to life? She was 12 years old. What does the number of 12 remind you of? Of God's people. That's not incidental. Jesus is declaring in healing this woman, in restoring this girl to life, he is revealing who he is and what he is about. I am Yahweh. I am your God. I have come to bring cleanness. I have come to heal you. I have come to give you life. He's come to meet their greatest need, to fulfill their deepest hope, to overcome their greatest fear. He has come to give life. He has come to make sinners clean. He has come to make dead people alive. He has come to make people who are sick because of sin healthy. Just believe. Just believe. Put your faith in me. Believe in me. Believe that I have paid the price. Believe that I have come to clean you, to cleanse you, to wash you. In 2005, sociologists Christian Smith and Melinda Denton published a book based on their research of the spiritual lives of American young people. Based on their research, they discovered five primary elements of what most young people, even those who grew up in the church, what they believed. And based on those five things, they coined the name moralistic therapeutic deism. Some of you perhaps have heard of that. It is a belief system that, according to their research, many young people, including many in the church in the U.S., it probably wouldn't be much different here in Canada, believed. And here's those five things. They believe that there is a God who exists, who created the world, and loosely watches over it. This is the God of deism that says there's a God. He wound up the world much like a clockmaker makes a clock, winds it up, and sets it on a shelf. He's there. He made it, but he's not really that involved. Secondly, that God wants people to be good and nice and fair to each other, as taught in the Bible and most world religions. You know, this would be the view that most faiths or all faiths kind of teach the same thing, that we're supposed to be good and nice and fair. That the central goal in life is to be happy and feel good about oneself. It makes it about us and not about the glory of God. Fourthly, that God doesn't need to be particularly involved in one's life except when God is needed to resolve a problem. And fifth and lastly, that good people go to heaven when they die. It's deeply concerning. Deeply concerning if that is what young people, if that is what people of any age believe when they think of Christianity, because moralistic therapeutic deism is not Christianity. It is not the gospel. It is not what is declared in this book. The gospel says that you and I are unclean, that we are sick, that we are spiritually dead. The call is not for us to try and muster up enough goodness and niceness and fairness that someday, because we're good enough, we go to heaven. This declares that we need Jesus' touch, that we need Jesus to touch us, and that when he touches us, that we are made clean, that we are made well, that we are given life, that life is found, redemption is found in Jesus, in reaching out to Jesus, that he came willingly. He came and he gave his life for us, suffering on the cross the death and the rejection and the exclusion that I deserve, that you deserve because of your sin and your rebellion. And that when I believe in him, he bears all my sin on himself. And he suffers for it. He suffers what I deserve. And by believing in him, I am then clothed with his perfection, with his righteousness, with his obedience. I am made clean in a moment by believing in him. It is found in him. Redemption is found in him. Salvation is found in him. We are made clean. We are made alive in him. Jesus has power to set people free from sin. Jesus has the power to make sick people well. Jesus has the power to make people who are spiritually dead spiritually alive. That's what we discover here. He says, just believe. Just believe. Now, we can't hear that and think somehow that that's just mental assent and we can go our jolly way and live whatever life we want. When we encounter the grace, the love, the power of Jesus, our lives will become lives that are being shaped and transformed by the gospel, that we would look more and more like Jesus. But our salvation is not something we achieve. It is something we desperately need and that Jesus willingly offers. Jesus comes and he reaches out to us. And he invites us to reach out to him. And it is his touch that makes us clean. It is his touch that heals us. It is his touch that makes us alive. Amen.